Welcome to a special edition of Legal AF. One of the things that we're looking at is the differences between our two parties, the values of those parties, what it would mean to have them actually operating the levers of power. We're seeing it with MAGA and Donald Trump, and we're seeing the Democrats try to have a conversation with America between now and the midterms to try to close the deal to take over the two chambers and ultimately, hopefully, the presidency in 2028. But is Donald Trump and all of his criminality, depravity, immorality, is that challenging the Democrats to come up with a contract with America or a set of agenda items that are going to reform the things that we see wrong in the Trump America or Trump era? That's a question, an existential question about our democracy that is worth having that dialogue right now to help shape the party. We just saw a new polling come out that says 70% of America rejects Donald Trump, but 65% of America rejects the Democrats as well. What do we do about that so we don't have people doing what happened last time, which is to sit on the sidelines of democracy and not vote at all? And I'm going to bring in now acclaimed actor, activist, and author, Peter Coyote. Hi, Peter.
Michael, thanks so much.
Okay. So you and I, before we got on, I wanted to kick around what was top of mind for you. And this issue is, why don't you frame it for our audience? And let's see if we can answer the questions by the time we're done with our interview.
Okay. So unlike Western European and Scandinavian parliaments, we have never protected our politics from the power of money. They're organized around money. So every compromise, every political compromise is made with the interests of money. Money doesn't compromise with the needs of the people or families or living wages or anything like that. And yet the subject itself is actually taboo. People will say, we need to get the money out of politics. But nobody will come up, stand on the floor of the Congress and say, we need full federal funding of elections. We need a ban or limits on corporate and great fortunes contributing. A corporation has one mandate, which is to increase the wealth of its shareholders. Why should they be allowed to skew public policy for their own benefit? And finally, if we had universal voting, you would never have to worry about gerrymandering. If we had a week to vote in, or if you had 2 days to vote in, you would begin to resemble a democracy. And if you could, let's say, become a candidate by paying $1,000 and getting 1,000 names on a petition, you'd have a whole different class of people volunteering to lead. Right now, our system selects for ambition and the ability to raise money. And I'm not talking about whether the candidates have goodwill or don't have goodwill or whether they're honorable or not. Every candidate has to deal with the hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars it takes to get into office and to stay in office and to buy alliances. And our Scandinavian and Western European partners have short-circuited that problem so that legislators actually get to vote their consciences without saying, gee, if I get to do this for the people, am I going to lose the money that gets me in office? And now, so under Ronald Reagan, the Fairness Doctrine was ended. Fairness Doctrine was a law from 1929 through the Reagan administration, which stated that the premise was that the airwaves belong to the American people, and what passes across them should be of utility and value to them. Which meant if you had me on your show and I maligned somebody, you would have to have that person back the next day to defend themselves. And so that went on until the Heritage Foundation and the wealth of think tanks funded by the Lewis Powell memo said, gee, you're curtailing our civil liberties, our rights of free speech. And Reagan defeated it. And within a month, you had single issue radio, you had the Rush Limbaughs, you had the Sinclair stations, you had Christian evangelicals and Christian nationalists all across the country with no restraint. They were not compelled to tell the truth. And then when Bill Clinton passed the Telecommunications Act, he ended the limitations on how many newspapers, television stations, and radio stations you could own. And within two years, we had gone from 50 diverse media corporations to three. And the enduring problem with that is this. The corporate sector owns every news platform, and they're under no compulsion to broadcast ideas with which they're not in disagreement, or with which they're not in agreement. So what's happened is that the bandwidth of political ideas has shrunk from, let's say, the center left, Rachel Maddow, to the far right. And I'm not maligning people for expressing what they believe in. I listen to Rachel, I listen to Nicole Wallace, I listen to CNN, but it's the farthest they go left is center left. So in a parliament, you have communists, socialists, Christian Democrats, social Democrats, healthcare party, Green Party. You have all these contending issues that have to come to compromises. And by some curious circumstance, they have all agreed to take light, heat, power, higher education, and healthcare out of the profit-making sector. They left a whole economy for entrepreneurs to get wealthy in, but everybody has a floor. So the problem is we have this shrunken bandwidth. So we don't ever get to hear the terms by which Finland made the best school systems in Europe, or how Japan did it, or why no Asian country will fund their school systems by zip code. So it's like we entered the World Series of Poker, and everybody got decks with 50 cards in them, and the Americans got 40. And so this is the thing that's vexing me right now. We can't get the ideas on the floor to say, hey, if we want the legislators to work for us, we should pay them. They work for who pays them. No fault, no blame. But if we want to change that, and we're not talking about money, and we're not talking about who gives it and who owns it and who owns the Supreme Court, we're not really addressing the problem. We're just being virtuous Democrats.
Absolutely. And let's talk about this. You and I talked a bit about virtue signaling, and I'm going to butcher it, and then you're going to fix it for me. You made a comment about how low a standard that Trump is setting. That you'll
he's a convicted fraudulent rapist.
So it's not hard for the Democrats to step over that. But you want more from the party. You want more for the Democrats in this, especially following the Trump era, where he's destroyed the relationship between the American people and their federal government, between the American people and their states, between the American people and their civil liberties. There's a lot of rebuilding and breach repair that's going to have to happen with the right leadership when starting hopefully in the midterms to heal America and its participatory democracy. Now, question for you is, what do you want the Democrats to do? What should they be doing in order to close this deal with America to get elected?
Well, the first thing they should be doing is being called by everyone who gets a request for money. Everyone, before they send a dollar, should have a list of questions saying, will you vote to move the Department of Justice back out of the executive suite? Will you fire the people that have messed up the FBI and DHS and Homeland Security and try to bring back some of the wealth of great minds and dedicated service to rebuild these agencies? Will you end the billionaire tax cuts? Will you tax them in some equitable fashion, given their, remember, from the end of World War II up through much of the 1960s, the tax rate on anything over $200,000, which today would be about $2 million, was 90%. And that's where the wealth that built the airports, the ports, the freeways, the research and development, the medical establishment, that's where it came from. Now, we don't have to hit that number. But after Reagan, and we were down in the 20s, that wealth has evaporated, and it's been substituted for by use taxes and sales taxes and all sorts of regressive stuff. So I want the Democrats to tell me, what are you going to do? What are you going to do about campaign finances? What are you going to do about a Supreme Court, which at least four members of can be proven to be bought and sold? And I think we have one great advantage. The new president will have all the expanded powers of Donald Trump. And if he's a Democrat, he could say, by executive order, every Supreme Court justice now has to follow the same standards of transparency and accountability as every other judge. And when they refuse, as they will, little Johnny Roberts will refuse to do this, standing on a separate but equal standard, then they should start impeachment hearings against Roberts for meeting his wife's clients who have cases before him, for Clarence Thomas, who has his hands in the billionaire's pockets, for Alito for flying the flag of the revolution while he was trying the cases, and for Kavanaugh because I just don't like him. He's a dull knife. Anyway, there are plenty of conservatives who have principle, who have standards, who you don't have to stack the court. But there's nothing in the Constitution, there is no single sentence that gives the Supreme Court the right to override legislative law. It's a practice that started during the Marshall Court. It was a huge power grab. It was an interpretation of Article 3, and we've just let it stand, and you can see where it got us. It got us a bought and paid for supermajority of right-wing people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I always joke that the Supreme Court uses the myth of originalism or textualism, but nowhere in the text of the Constitution defines the power of the Supreme Court to declare the law of the land.
Yeah.
That came from Marbury versus Madison.
Yeah, exactly. And the Marshall Court.
They never explained that. Like, well, after that, well, then we look at the text.
So here's a fair segue into my book. What the book is about is that most people don't know that Trump is not an accident. There has been a plan afoot backed by hundreds of millions of dollars since 1968 when Lewis Powell, who was on the board of directors of Philip Morris, think Marlboro, hated the civil rights movement. He said America has done all it can for the Negro. He hated the Vietnam War protesters. He hated the liberal faculty members on the universities. He hated the news broadcasters like Edward R. Murrow and Huntley and Brinkley. And he wrote a 38-page memo, which you can read. You can find it on Google. It's a declaration of war against liberal democracy. It's called the Powell Memorandum. 38 pages, he sent it to a friend on the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And it was immediately pulled below water level by the Koch brothers, Joseph Coors, Richard Scaife, who's a Mellon, people like the DeVos family, America's great fortunes. And what they did, down on the down low, they started funding and creating the Heritage Foundation, the Claremont Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, the Cato Institute, the Manhattan Institute, hundreds of thousands of dollars to hosers to sit around and come up with language and concepts to invalidate the government's ability to regulate the corporate sector. And they've been doing that, and they've made alliances with the Christian evangelists. This was Reagan's great movement. I'll make you as rich as Croesus. You give me your voters. And they've been doing that since 1973, which was when it was published. So first they put Nixon in office. Then they put Reagan in office, who declared government the enemy. They put Newt Gingrich in office, who declared the Democrats were evil. They put Pat Buchanan in office, who brought in the militias and brought in the Christian evangelicals. And there's been this subterranean group that has been spending, the money is listed in my book, hundreds of millions of dollars a year, making sure that every picture of a burning police car is spread nationally, that everything that will weaken government has been turned through the think tank treacle mill. And there are concepts like individual freedom, and you don't want government on your back, and they've linked government to long lines in the post office. But we're all the victims of this total usurpation of the public sector, the airwaves, and the political sector by money.
And the book, before we move on to your book, in the notes below, I put the link for the Powell memo. so you can read exactly what Peter's talking about for yourself. Looks like it was typed up on an old Selectronic IBM typewriter back in the day. My dad had one of those. The book, and we'll put it up here on the screen, is Smothered by Riches, and you can reach it for a very reasonable price of $10 or free if you get it on Kindle. Talk about the premise of the book, about the, from your perspective, you talked briefly about your background. For those that only know you from movies and television or narrating anything that Ken Burns does, you're also a participant in the 1960s counterculture movement. You're an activist. You've written many books on this issue. This is something that animates your life. So talk about wealth and freedom and the mythology that people have among them about themselves in America that's been placed there by the mass media and the rest, and what it's doing as a corrosive element to our democracy.
Okay, let me work my way through there. Let me stop with the word activist, because I never use the word activist. This is one of those think tank words. This is a word invented by your enemies. If you want to separate someone from the great mass of humanity, you put an IST after their name. A communist, a socialist, an artist, an environmentalist, an activist. And the implication is that most people just go along and don't really believe in anything. And a few radical individuals are too extreme, but they're the activists. I turn it around. If you don't believe in what your life is about and engaged with, you're a hypocrite. I'm engaged with my life. I'm not an activist. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, I was one of the organizers of a group called the Grinnell 14, were the only protesters ever invited into the White House by President Kennedy in the history of the White House. We scheduled this thing. We planned it out. Before the internet, we wrote letters to 100 colleges. We kept protests in front of the White House against resumption of nuclear testing and supporting Kennedy's peace race for a year. And in February of 1963 was the first 25,000 student gathering in Washington, which Tom Hayden called the Grinnell 14, the beginning of the student protest movement. So I grew up in a liberal family of Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jews, communists, socialists, do-gooders, union organizers, and I came of age during the McCarthy period, watching grown-ups weeping in my living room, people who in their 20s had been communists, then they became teachers or professors or businessmen, and they were called to account to the McCarthy hearings, and if they wouldn't give the names of their friends, they'd never work again. And they were lying about my relatives. They were saying they were traitors, they were spies, they were this and that. And I came in at 12 years old, and I saw the power that the federal government could wreak against individuals. So I've always been on that side of the line, the Dorothy Day, the Wobblies, you know, the Beatniks, people who had a compassionate heart and wanted to abate the suffering of others. So against that, there has been this mythology that the only unit of measure for success that we really look at in America is fame and wealth. And actually, if you're famous, you can get wealthy. And so we have these hosers like Lutnick, you know, they have an ability to make money. Zuckerberg, you know, these guys just have a curious mind. They have an algorithm. They made a lot of money. And in a system that is run by money, they run the system. And so one of the things that I talk about all the time is every time you go on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Whole Foods, Amazon, you are sending nickels into the pockets of the fascists that are ruining your country. And you think you're getting something out of it. You're getting pretty kitty, new dance steps, you're getting animal videos, getting chicks with big boobs, whatever it is. And they are clocking everything about you. And when Trump came up for office, Cambridge Analytica went to Facebook and said, we want the profiles of impressionable people. And they got a whole bunch of mouth breathers and they put them in the same room with Russian bots and they put Rumpelstiltskin in office. So we are collaborating in our own ruin because we're too indulgent to sit down and write a letter and say, I'm not getting another Apple. I'm not getting another iPhone. I'm not shopping in your store until you stop this behavior. And if the 8 million people who showed up at No King's Day did that to five companies, you could compress their earnings by a half or 1%. And by law, it would have to be published. And then the shareholders would take over and they would demand changes. But it requires a little long-term thinking and a little consistency.
Absolutely. Look, from our perspective, let's just take what we do here on Legal AF and on the Midas Touch Network. We have no choice but to platform our ideas and people here on Google, YouTube, X, even though it breaks my heart, because it is where our audience is. We don't have the alternative. If we had the alternative, we would platform ourselves there. So it's not that we had a choice and we chose the dark side. It's like we chose to use that platform for good, even though we have no alternative.
Well, you do have Blue Sky and you do have Substack.
And we're on it. And we're on it.
Okay. So I keep telling, I'm not judging you for doing that.
Oh, no. I'm just, it's more of a lament.
Yeah. Yeah. So the question is, like, you have a specific reason. If I lived in the only place where the only organic food I could get would be Whole Foods, I'd say buy Whole Foods. But if you have options, I can buy everything I want on eBay. I can get it off the original stores. I don't need Amazon. So I can do that. And so I'm just trying to make the connection between our indulgences and the money we spend and the people we're empowering. But you asked me about freedom. So the part you left out of my biography is that I'm an ordained Zen Buddhist priest.
I was waiting for you to bring that up.
I'm a transmitted teacher, which means my teacher stuck a meat thermometer in me, said, you're done, and I can ordain my own priests, and I've transmitted my own successors. So there's two ways of looking at the world, and they're both true. The conventional way is you're over there, and I'm over here, and we're separate. We're individual people. We're not attached. If I shoot myself in the head, you don't fall down. But from another point of view, you and I have never been separate from oxygen, from sunlight, from microbes in the soil, from pollinating insects, from the people spinning the cotton and sewing it and shipping it for your clothing. So on the big picture, the Buddhists call it emptiness or boundaryless. There's a kind of fundamental energy which produces the entire visible world. And everything you see is that energy. So I don't like it that I'm made of the same stuff as Donald Trump. But it's true. And it means that when I look at the world and when I deal with people, I have to do it. I can no longer pretend that if I can just get rid of evil, everything will be okay. Because I'm a human being. And I know that a human being's nature is the nature of nature, that I'm 50% negative and 50% positive. And if I know that, I can be responsible for monitoring my negative energy. I can make sure it doesn't get past my lips or into my muscles. People who think they're the good guys wound up carpet bombing Baghdad hotels in the middle of the night. And when I was on, what's his name? Who's that comedian? Thinks he's the smartest guy in the world.
Oh, Bill Maher?
Yeah. When I was on his show and I said, this is a war crime. I was on the night we were bombing Baghdad and said, this is a war crime. Some woman started screaming at me that I needed to leave America, you know, and he didn't speak up.
Well, because he was working on getting the Mark Twain Award from Donald Trump.
Right? I think he was trying to get onto HBO
onto HBO.
Anyway, yeah.
Well, people's true colors are certainly being shown now. But let me ask you something. You talk about in your book sort of the myths that are pushed on America, part of the prosperity of America, the picket fence and all of that. And if you could disabuse our audience of one or two of those myths to make their life better and to see more clearly, right? To have the scales drop from their eyes, especially in time for voting. What would they be?
Well, I'll tell you, there are two banks to the Rubicon. There's the rich side and there's the not rich side. I lived on both. When I was a kid growing up, my dad was a very wealthy man. He was the president of a railroad and an oil company and a stock brokerage firm. He and his partner in Texas smuggled these white French cows across the Rio Grande, painting black spots on them, make them Holsteins. Anyway, and it was always embarrassing to me being sent to school in a leather-covered chauffeur limousine. It's like I just wanted to be fixing cars with my friends or whatever it was. And then he lost it. He lost every penny, every house, every acre, all the antiques, all the books, all of it. He died at 67. But I was so opposed to his value system. His metaphor for life was there's three men in a rowboat, in a lifeboat, with food enough for two. And he felt that capitalism demanded that the two strong guys kill the weak guy. And when I try to say, listen, if the three guys cooperate, they protect their humanity, you protect civilization, they might all make it. If they don't, they'll still die as human beings. He would say, survival of the fittest and wander off. So I didn't want any part of that. So I went in 10 years in the counterculture, living on communes. I never made $2,500 a year. Part of it was good. I had lots of time to think about the world and learn a lot of stuff. Part of it was not so good. I had family trauma that I couldn't quell with all the heroin in California. But I tried, believe me. Anyway, there is this idea that wealth or privilege is going to solve every problem you have. My dad was a warrior. He was an angry Jew born at a time when Jews were not white people. When I was born, 1941, Jews were not white people. I couldn't go swimming at the country club a block from my house. So this infuriated my dad. He went to MIT at 15, and he spent much of his life showing these guys he was smarter, tougher, better. And it consumed his life. He had the stomach taken out for ulcers. He had 15 kidney stone attacks. He became a drug addict because of the pain. And I looked at that and I thought, if that's what riches produce, I don't want any part of it. And then I looked at friends of his who he had around who became my mentors, jazz musicians. One was an ex-game warden who was the manager of our ranch. And I saw these people just content with being quiet, content with being like gold nuggets that sunk to the bottom of the ocean, of the stream, not the white water that the media covers, but just people in the depths generating light and heat. And I thought, that's for me. So to me, freedom is being able to stand at a lamppost and do nothing. The president of the United States can't do that. I can take a week off and do whatever I want. I don't have to get out of bed. I've saved my money. I worked hard. I've got a union pension. It's not a lot, but it's enough. So the first thing I suggest to people is find your number. What's your number? What's enough? $1 million in savings will throw off $40,000 a year. Can you live on $40,000 a year? If not, you got to figure out some way to make more. But if you don't have enough, you're always letting your fears generate some possibility where you need more and more and more. So the first freedom is that the first myth is that wealth is not freedom. Wealth, unless you're born with it, and those people are not free either because they spend all their time trying not to lose it. That's not freedom. So the second is fame is not going to save your life. Look at all the suicides. Look at all the talent. I used to run around with Janis Joplin. I think of a heroin overdose as a suicide. You look at Philip Seymour Hoffman, you look at the young English guy who did Brokeback Mountain. These are tragedies. So somewhere along the line, what Buddha taught was there's nothing that comes up inside you that you can't handle if you sit still and just let it come up. Where we get in trouble is running away. Running away from what we're afraid of or from what we can't tolerate. You wind up shopping too much, spending too much, being in the wrong bed, drinking too much, drugging. So the third noble truth was called containment. And what he taught was that if you practice just sitting still and breathing 15, 20, 30 minutes a day, you will start to understand the nature of your mind, the insubstantiality of your thoughts, and you won't be pushed around by be all you can be. Oh, if I can't get my kid the Nike shoes he wants, it's all over, you know? So I read somewhere that we see a billion ads by the time we're 13 years old. So there are industries keeping us discontented, and that's keeping us locked in as employees. I was in a gang in the 60s called the Diggers, and we thought that the problems with America were profit and private property. So we did everything for free. And we had free stores in which we had televisions, we had tools, we had furniture that people would give away, we'd fix it. And the subtext was to say to people, why do you want to be an employee to make the money to be a consumer? We'll give you the shit. Now, right. what do you really want to do?
Right.
What do you really want to do? We fed 600 people a day. All they had to do was pass through a 6-foot by 6-foot yellow square called the free frame of reference. Bring a bowl and a spoon and step through the free frame of reference. And people would say, well, I can afford to buy my food. We say, yeah, but wouldn't you like to live in a world with free food? Oh, yeah. So it was a theater piece. It wasn't an actual alternative. But our feeling was that Americans were never going to throw themselves on the barricades to be the lumpen proletariat. But if they built lives that they appreciated and respected, they might defend them. And so that's what we set out. Do your thing was the model for authenticity. Who are you? Don't be ashamed of it. What do you really want?
Yeah.
Go for that.
Well, let's hope that the Democratic Party can take a lesson from Peter Coyote and start shaping its message and its values to accomplish the things that need to be accomplished. We're going to have to heal the planet and global relationships. We're going to have to heal this democracy and the republic. And it's got to start somewhere. And I can't think of a better place than listening to the deep thoughts of Peter Coyote. And he's got a book that's out that we're promoting here by way of having Peter on, Smothered by Riches. You can get it in Amazon. You can get it in Kindle. You can get it in your local bookstore. And Peter, so glad you're here to brief our audience and to start this dialogue with them. And hopefully, even if you just get one or two people to follow up on some of the things you've talked about and the values you've talked about, the authenticity you've talked about, I think it's all been worthwhile. What do you think?
I think a journey of 1,000 miles starts with the first step.
That's it.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you for being here, Peter Coyote, and you're here on Legal AF. Take a minute, hit the free subscribe button as we continue to grow this pro-democracy channel.